Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already. She's my mom, so I know her. But for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share. She is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal Series, five wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, including Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and Susan's latest book, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses at the Wise Woman University. But you can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Justine. It's always such a pleasure to hear your loving voice. And welcome, Rebecca. Great to be with you again for another Tuesday evening.
Great to be with you as well.
Yes. So here it is. All right. You know, people are saying, oh, my gosh, suddenly it's winter. We're going, yeah. It's not so sudden, though, but it's cold. We're still doing lots of work with plants, though. And, you know, part of that work, of course, is things that we've harvested earlier in the year and dried, and now we're cutting them and putting them away. But we're still making stuff, too. We went out to our CSA farm, and where they had harvested the pumpkins last month was all grown in with chickweed. You have chickweed popping up where you are, Rebecca?
Yes, we have it sparsely here. You have to really go and look for it in Eugene for some reason, unfortunately, because it's so prolific so many places. But here, it's, you see little tiny bits of it, you know, along the paths and stuff, but not, like, big bunches.
Yeah, like places that I dependably find it in Oregon are around compost piles.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Because it really likes a fertile soil. And in deltas, where, you know, where the freshwater streams go toward the ocean,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of fan out as they get there, all along those banks you're going to find chickweed. And in planters, especially city planters.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I sent my class in Amsterdam out on a pretty cold February day to see what they could find, and they actually came back after only an hour with 30 medicinal and edible plants, and chief among them was chickweed, which was growing in all the planting boxes throughout Amsterdam. As a weed, nobody had planted it. So it may be cold, it may be the winter, but green blessings are still everywhere around you. What are we doing tonight? We've got some questions that people have emailed in. And I always enjoy it when people call in and I get to talk to you. So we hope that some of you will do that this evening too. And then at 9 o'clock, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Susan Shumsky, who is dedicated to helping you take command of your life in an effective, powerful, and positive way. And she's the author of 10 books, but more about that later on. Shall we get started with some questions, Rebecca?
Yes, you have a caller waiting to talk to you, so...
Oh, good. Let's start with a caller. Wonderful.
All right. In the 516 area code, do you have a question for Susan?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes. Go right ahead.
Oh, I am delighted to talk to you. My name's Catherine, and I firstly want to thank you for having the courage, Susan, to share all your wisdom with so many women through your books and your websites, and I'm glad I got a chance to tell you that with my voice.
Thanks so much.
So my question is somewhat general. I found out 5 years ago that I have inherited what's called the BRCA1 mutation from my mother's side of the family, and it's taken me that amount of time to really decide how to take control of that health issue. And I'm drinking my nourishing herbal infusions, and I love them. And I just want to know if you could speak generally about any other directions I should look at for help.
How old did you say you were?
Oh, I didn't say. I'm 41. I've had 2 healthy pregnancies, and I've nursed for a total of 50 months, and I had my children in my early 20s.
Okay. Well, what I'm about to say will probably surprise you amazingly.
Okay.
But one of the very best ways to reduce the risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer, because that mutation, 25, 30 years ago, when prophylactic mastectomies were first offered, many of the women wound up dying of ovarian cancer.
Right.
Because that mutation goes both ways there. So it's not just breast, it's also ovarian. But one of the very best, simplest ways to slash your risk of both breast cancer and ovarian cancer, and the breast cancer risk reduction is 1,000%, is to take birth control pills.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, I'm not putting this woman forward as like a model for woman or all women should be like this. I'm telling her story, and I wish I knew her name, but I don't. Because she represents for me what's natural and normal for women. And by kind of putting out, shall we say, an icon of what's natural and normal for women, we can then kind of look and see what we're doing that might not be so natural and normal. And I certainly include myself in that. So this woman lives in India, and she was married when she was 14 years old. And she has been basically pregnant or lactating for 50 years, and she has never once had a menstrual period.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And because her dietary status is not good, there were 3 to 4 years between her children.
Uh-huh.
So she doesn't even really have that many children. But she never menstruated, not once.
Wow.
Now that is natural and normal for human women. Mm-hmm. And so, I look at my life and I say, well, gee, I haven't chosen what's natural and normal. You know, after I had my first child, I did everything in my power to not have a second child until I wanted that second child. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to menstruate. Now, what actually happened for me was I did wind up taking birth control pills. And in retrospect, I'm very glad I did. There are some risks certainly associated with taking birth control pills. And those risks are blood clots. And those are much more frequent among women who smoke. So I usually suggest that you not smoke. You are into your 40s. And that's why I was asking, because, of course, the younger you are when you start taking birth control pills, the more effective the protection is.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
But it's certainly something to consider, to do some research on, and to really see if that's something that would be useful to you. Another possibility is, in terms of the ovarian cancer risk, is to take ginkgo.
Ah, okay.
And in when I was researching for Down There, The Wise Woman Way, I came across a very, very interesting study that found that women who take ginkgo biloba, tincture or capsules once or twice a day for 6 months or longer are 60% less likely to have ovarian cancer. There are substances in the ginkgo called ginkgolides, which kill cancer cells in the ovaries.
Very interesting.
And ginkgo is a pretty benign herb. Whether or not it increases memory, certainly decreases the risk of ovarian cancer. And
okay,
that's once or twice a day, tincture capsules, for 6 months, and if you like it, you can continue to do it. So I say, hey, why not?
Right.
If it's going to cut my risk of a scary cancer, then I'm certainly happy to do that. Your risk increase because you carry that genetic mutation is a very large risk increase, but it's not 100%.
Right. Thank you for saying that, because when I met with my genetic counselor who told me about this, you know, positive result some years back, she focused, I mean, she was very professional and tried to be very positive, but was focusing on the fact that my risk is 80%. I'm 80%, you know, I just kept seeing this pie chart and the big, you know, 80% slice. I didn't see the 20% slice. So I appreciate you pointing it out that I don't have to sit in that big slice if I don't want to.
Correct.
Right. And
correct.
Yeah. So, I mean,
and
if anyone
we were
else
to say,
out there,
hey, I take ginkgo, I'm going to reduce my risk by 60%. I have this mutation increases my risk by 80%, 80 minus 60, 20%.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's,
you know,
it's a scary thing.
You've got your risk way down just by one simple thing.
Okay. Okay. Well, that I really appreciate. I know that you've had some information. I think that there was a video or a webinar that you did about this particular mutation. Am I correct about that?
I have mentioned it. Of course, it's been in the news.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, a high-profile person is diagnosed with this. Well, we're going to hear a lot about it.
Right.
But it's certainly something that I've been aware of for over 20 years. And women's various reactions to finding out that they did or did not have this mutation. And I mean, really, I have just seen such outrageous things. I mean, I met a woman who was born on an organic farm, has eaten nothing but organic food her entire life, and was diagnosed with breast cancer in her 30s.
Mm.
I met an 11-year-old girl who had just been diagnosed with breast cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
I stood by the bed of a woman who definitely had breast cancer because all the metastases were breast cells, but there was no cancer that could be found in her breast. Even though there was cancer in her bones and her lungs and her liver.
Oh, gosh.
So what I'm hoping to say is there are no guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
Cancer is not a punishment. by an angry god or an unangry god or any kind of god or goddess for anything that we have done. In fact, if we think about it, cancer cells are the youngest, healthiest, fastest growing cells in our bodies. That's why they kill us.
Yeah, I've heard you speak about that, and also in your book, Breast Cancer,
Breast Health,
exclamation point. Right. I love the writing where you say, you ask the reader, you know, what is right about this cancer? You know, how do I embrace it? Or what's, you know, like you said, it's not a punishment. It's a part of us, I suppose. Yes?
Yeah. So the cancers that seem to be more aggressive are cancers that eat estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
The medical profession actually prefers when women have these kinds of cancers because they have special drugs that can block that.
Okay.
Meanwhile, here you are in your 40s. Sounds like you have a happy family.
I do.
It might be a good idea to sit down and talk to your ovaries and say, listen, girls, we don't need to keep ovulating. That's what the birth control pills do, right? They stop ovulation.
Well, I asked my doctor about that, and she said that no birth control pill stops ovulation 100%.
No, only about 99.7%.
Okay.
I got pregnant while taking birth control pills.
Well, that's what happened to me.
It's certainly possible.
It is possible.
But what the hormones and birth control pills do is to tell your body it's already pregnant.
Right. Right.
So there's no reason to ovulate.
Okay.
And you don't actually menstruate. If you stop taking the pills, there's a breakthrough bleeding, but it's not an actual menstruation.
Okay. Now, I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that. Okay. Well, that is...
And what I'm saying is that you could sit down, and you can talk to your ovaries. Have an ongoing conversation with your ovaries and say, girls, that's it. Close up shop. Go on vacation. Retire. We don't need you to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And as they do that, the hormone that they have been making, actually the ovaries don't make it, but the whole cycle of ovulation, which includes the ovary, causes estradiol to be made. And estradiol is such a potent form of estrogen that it is to breast cancer as kerosene is to fire.
Ah.
So kerosene doesn't cause fire, and estradiol doesn't cause breast cancer. But if there's a spark in kerosene, there's not going to be a fire, but a shoo. Right, you know, a conflagration, the same thing. So it's not just any estrogen. And this is confusing to people because they hear or they read that red clover contains phytoestrogens or plant estrogens.
Mm-hmm.
And then they read that estrogen promotes breast cancer. So they say, well, I shouldn't be using red clover if I'm worried about breast cancer. And there's actually, I am sorry to say, on at least one website, and possibly more out on the internet, there is information saying that red cancer is dangerous for women.
Red clover is
dangerous for women who are worried about breast cancer. In fact, just the opposite is true.
Mm-hmm.
Because the kinds of estrogens that your body makes in the presence of red clover does not actually contain estrogen, but it contains precursors that allow your body to make estrogens if your body wants them. And these are estrogens that actually block the action of estradiol.
Interesting.
So this is, in fact, they act very much like tamoxifen acts.
Well, that's the medicine that was potential, you know, a recommendation. I could take tamoxifen preemptively, you know, before there's any signs of growth. Like I could start taking it now, you know, was one recommendation.
It's the recommendation for women who don't want to do surgery. They should start taking tamoxifen.
Right, right.
And tamoxifen is estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the similar kind of estrogens that you can make when you're drinking red clover.
Okay.
So this is why I very stoutly say red clover is perfectly safe for women who have a diagnosis, women who are worried, or women like myself who just want to be sure they're free from breast cancer.
Right.
I wouldn't go a week without drinking a quart of red clover infusion. I don't drink it every day. Not necessary to drink it every day. A quart a week is a good amount.
Okay.
If you wanted to do more, if you wanted to do 2 quarts a week, you certainly could.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, I go through, you know, all of them, the ones that you recommend, the nettle, the comfrey, the linden, the red clover, and the, oh, who am I missing? Oat straw, which is my favorite.
Yeah.
That one, yes. Great.
So you're definitely getting a quart of red clover a week,
mm-hmm.
which sounds, you know, absolutely perfect to me. When people say to me, well, you know, red clover contains phytoestrogens, I say, first of all, it doesn't really contain estrogen. It contains phytosterols. And if you wanted to avoid phytosterols, it would mean that you would have to avoid eating any seed. So that includes all grain, corn, rice, oats, any beans, any nuts. Those are all seeds. Nor could you eat roots or leaves because they all contain phytosterols.
Oh, gosh.
So to point a finger at red clover is really, to me, is pretty funny.
Yeah.
When you consider the huge numbers of sources of phytosterols in the diet.
Did I hear, was it Rebecca or Justine mention a week or so ago that she'd just sown some red clover this time of year?
I think
I
that was Rebecca.
That. Yes, that was me.
It'll start, you know, the weather's not totally deep freeze yet, or maybe it is up in the Catskills where you are. Will it start to sprout and then, you know, survive the winter, or are you just putting the seeds in now so that they'll sprout in the spring?
I put them in a few weeks ago, and they'll stay, I live in on the West Coast, so
okay.
I live in a different climate than Susan does, but they come up and they'll stay green throughout the wintertime, actually.
Ah, lucky. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Rebecca lives in Oregon, out on the West Coast, and the winters don't get quite as severe there as they do here. They can have cold temperatures, but it's more open, and you can keep green crops in the garden. It's hard for me to overwinter kale because we'll usually get, you know, anywhere from a couple of nights to a couple of weeks of temperatures well below zero. Fahrenheit.
Right.
Plants just don't like that. Whereas where Rebecca is, it's not that cold, and so she can keep green plants growing year-round, although they're still frozen. My brother lives in Oregon also and farms there, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I hope this has helped you.
It's extremely helpful. Thanks.
And we should probably get on to the next caller, but don't feel that any door is shut. We certainly welcome people calling back.
Thank you, and it's helped me, and I hope that it may have helped anyone else listening. Good night.
Good night. Green blessings.
Bye-bye.
Okay, it doesn't look like we have anybody else holding for a question, but we can go into the email here. And our question is about ginkgo, actually, so...
You made that up.
Hi,
you knew I was going to be talking about ginkgo.
Hi, Susan. I was thrilled to be with you in your intensive class at the Southeast Wise Woman Herbal Conference in Black Mountain in October. My sister has a huge old ginkgo tree in Biltmore Forest in Asheville. She was going to tincture the leaves for me as they turned yellow and fell from the tree, as they do every year, all in one day. This year, the frost came on Friday night, and on Saturday morning, all the many, many leaves on the ancient tree had fallen to the ground during the night, many of them not totally yellow yet. Was it okay to tincture them? We have done so, as she is moving next year, and we won't have access to this very old, beautiful tree. Many, many blessings.
Yes, it's perfectly fine. The, shall we say, traditional method of making ginkgo tinctures exactly as you describe it. Wait for that frost, wait for the leaves to get yellow, and kind of catch them as they're falling down off the tree and tincture them. But over the past decade or so, with more kind of laboratory looking into what's going on with ginkgo, some people have focused on the polyphenols. Maybe you've heard that word, polyphenol. You've heard about polyphenols in green tea, for instance, or polyphenols in fruit juices like pomegranate juice. Polyphenols are very active antioxidants. And it turns out that ginkgo has a lot of polyphenols, but it has more polyphenols when it's green than when it's yellow. Well, hey, that's what we just said about tea, isn't it? That the green tea has the most polyphenols, and then as the tea matures or ages or is aged, right, and turned into other kinds of tea, we lose those polyphenols. Now, with tea, lots of other interesting things go on, and other antioxidants are actually formed. And we don't know whether or not that happens with ginkgo, but nowadays, some of the bigger tincture manufacturers are actually doing two different ginkgo tinctures, which they mix together, a summer tincture of the green leaves, and then that early winter tincture of the yellow leaves, and then they mix them together, and they feel that that gives the most medicine from the ginkgo. Well, it sounds like pretty much like that's just what you did, shall we say, just from gut feeling. So hooray for your gut feeling. You're doing great.
Okay, next question from the email. I have a bit of a dilemma, and I was wondering if you could help me. I have been trying to get pregnant for the last 3 years. I have turned 46 in July. The problem is that I have had an extremely stressful event with my family. They got me very angry with a big lie, and I felt betrayed. 3 years ago, and since then, all my hormonal health went down the drain overnight. I had been tested just a few months before the stress, and apparently my hormones were that of a young woman. I had regular periods as well. Then the stress came. I had not had a period for more than 2 months afterwards, so I took progesterone to induce it. My follicle-stimulating hormone at that point was around 60. Since then, my FSH has been very high. Recently, it was 91, estrogen 18, and progesterone 0.5. Only two periods this year. If all this hormonal decline were happening naturally, then I would think that it is it and that my menopause came earlier. I would not fight it. But since it is the stress that wrecked my body, then I am hoping that something can be done to pull me out. What do you think? Can anything be done, or am I grasping at straws? It just seems too early to go into menopause for me. I am thinking maybe energy medicine. How helpful are herbs in a situation like mine? I took progesterone recently to induce bleeding, but nothing happened, not even a drop. Oh, and I forgot to mention that I have low libido, and so does my husband. It does not make things any easier to make a baby, does it? I would like to fix my libido as well. I am looking forward to your thoughts.
All right, let's start where I always like to start, which is just a few facts. When we are in our mother's uterus, we all start out life as females. And the uterine environment is very high in a great number of different estrogens. If we have XX in all of our cells, then we make use of those estrogens and we remain female. And if we have XY, we can't make use of those estrogens and we become male. The presence of those estrogens is then added to by our own bodies. Somewhere around the midpoint of gestation, 4.5, 5.5 months, our ovaries are already formed, and we actually start making 29 kinds of estrogen. Those are called baseline estrogen. We make those, as I said, from about midpoint in our gestation until the day we die. So There's never a time when any woman is really estrogen deficient. And when hormone levels are tested at a doctor's, they actually don't test for baseline estrogen. They only test for estradiol, the dangerous estrogen. So I really put no store at all by the levels of estrogen from any test at all. So we have baseline estrogen. Baseline estrogen is there before we're born. It's there when we're born. It's there when we're little girls. It's there when we're grown women. It's there the day we die. We got baseline estrogen. It's there. It's there. What's different? Well, at puberty, we start making that dangerous estrogen, estradiol. And at menopause, we stop making that dangerous estrogen, estradiol. Estradiol, as I just said earlier, is to breast cancer as kerosene is to fire. And so we do spend some of our lives making this hormone, but if we were to continue to make it into our lives, it would probably kill us because it truly is a dangerous hormone. When we start menstruating, when we go through puberty and start menstruating and start making estradiol, the levels are erratic and they kind of go up and down, and that's what makes that first year or even year or two for some women really problematic as they move into their menstrual life. And each month, starting from puberty, the amount of estradiol that we make increases. And this happens from the beginning of our menstruation at puberty right up until usually about our mid-20s. For some women, even up into their early 30s. But for all women, by the time we get into our early 30s, we are already starting to produce less estradiol. As estradiol levels go down, follicle-stimulating hormone levels go up, FSH, and luteinizing hormone levels go up as well. Progesterone, similarly, tends to go down because it's not a hormone that we are going to need. All women have already hormonally begun menopause by their mid-30s. For some women, the month-by-month drop-off of estradiol is pretty fast. And so by the time they're in their late 30s, they are actually having menopausal symptoms. For other women, the drop-off is more gradual. And so they don't start noticing menopausal symptoms until their mid-40s. You aren't too young. You are in menopause. I hear you that your family betrayed you. I hear you that you feel terrible about this. I hear you. There was incredible stress, but it didn't cause a hormonal imbalance. You're in menopause. If your family was loving you, you'd still be in menopause. If your family hadn't lied to you, you'd still be in menopause. What your family did, I take it from what you say, was a terrible thing. And I'll take it from you that it was a terrible thing, but it didn't cause menopause. You know, cause and effect is where human beings fall down the fastest. We see one thing and then we see another thing happen right after it. We say, oh, thing A caused thing B, but not so. In fact, that's why we have the scientific tradition, so that we can distinguish between what we think is cause and effect and what is really cause and effect. So the hormones of a younger woman is a meaningless statement. We don't want to have anything that is not appropriate to our actual age. If indeed in your mid-40s you had the hormones of a younger woman, how much younger are we talking about? Are we talking before puberty? Well, it sounds like that wouldn't be what you wanted. Are we talking at the point where estradiol is the highest? Well, you know what? You're in your 40s now. If estradiol was that high in your body, you'd get breast cancer from it. So you don't want the hormones of a younger woman. You want the hormones of a woman who's in her mid-40s. That's who you are. You are a woman in her mid-40s. You are a menopausal woman. Now, personally, just for me, I do think that you should give up the idea of having a child. But if you really insist, there are two things you could do. You can start taking Vitex tincture, also known as chaste tree berries. The dosage needs to be fairly large, 2 to 4 dropperfuls as a dose, and that dose is taken 2 to 4 times a day. So that could be as little as 4 dropperfuls, 2 dropperfuls twice a day, or as much as 16 dropperfuls, 4 dropperfuls 4 times a day. We usually suggest that women start small and build up to their tolerance with this. Vitex Agnus Castus, chaste tree berries, seem to reset the hormonal clock, lowering levels of follicle-stimulating hormone and lowering levels of luteinizing hormone and increasing levels of estradiol. But remember that estradiol is a problematic hormone. It does, however, trigger ovulation, and if you want to get pregnant, then you're going to need to trigger ovulation. One of the reasons that I said I think that you should give up on this idea of having a baby is what you ended with, which is you don't have a libido. Your husband doesn't have a libido. So I guess to me it just seems like you're kind of pushing yourselves to do something that maybe your minds are involved in, but your bodies don't want to participate in it. After all, it is your bodies who have to do these things. Have you thought of adopting? I mean, if you're that desperate for a child, there are a lot of children already there who would be thrilled to have you as loving parents. If it's about having a child, it doesn't have to be a child of your body, especially if your body doesn't want to do this. In addition to taking Vitex tincture, you could also drink red clover infusion, weighing out 1 ounce of red clover blossoms, putting it into a quart jar, filling it right up to the top of the boiling water, putting a tight lid on it, and letting it sit for at least 4 hours or overnight. Then straining it, squeezing the plant material to get all the liquid out of it, refrigerating that liquid, and composting or returning to the earth the spent red clover blossoms. Red clover increases women's chances of getting pregnant. There is one further thing that I tell all women over 40 who ask me for advice about getting pregnant, and that is that the name of your game is now miscarriage. Your eggs are no longer in good shape, and his sperm are no longer in good shape, and that's part of the reason why your libido is not what it was. So if his sperm and your egg get together, and neither one of them is very good quality, then your body is going to pull the plug on any conception that doesn't look to it like it's really going to be viable. And this can happen the first couple of weeks you're pregnant. It can happen after you've been pregnant 3 or 4 months. I know women in their 40s who have babies who miscarried 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times before they were successful. If you have the emotional stamina to go through repeated miscarriages, and I don't think you do, given what your letter says, then use Vitex and red clover and see if you can get pregnant. But once again, let me say, you're in menopause. Your bodies are clearly telling you, yours and your husband's, that it's not the time to have a child. I think it's the time to think about yourself and to let this idea of having a child manifest in some other way than by trying to force your body into doing something that it doesn't seem to me that it wants to do. It's very natural for women going through menopause to have no libido at all. A very big change is happening in your body. And when that change is done, you will not be able to conceive. At that point, your libido will return. But for the duration, I suggest that you be at ease and find ways to be intimate, loving, and even sexy with your husband without having intercourse or direct sexual connection. It could be a glance. It could be a smile. It could be a love note. It could be stroking the side of his face. There's so many ways to be close, to be intimate, and to use our bodies for pleasure. I know that a lot of what I said was very fierce. I hope that you can hear it and understand.
Are you ready for the next question here?
I am indeed.
Okay. What can you tell me about Sawol? There are many articles on it on the net, but basically all say about the same thing, not a lot of details. Right now I have the leaf and stems. Berries are all gone for the season. I am trying to dry the leaf, and they are a thicker, hardier leaf, and I don't know when they are dry. Just dried some alder leaves. They were like normal leaves when dry. Could tell when they were dry, but these sawol leaves, I cannot tell. They don't seem to crunch up like the alder does. Do I need to dry them longer? Then what do I do with them after they are dry? Grind them up into powder? Can you mix them with something like olive oil? What about the stems? Also, the alder leaves, same question. I am basically new to herbs in the woods. Well, herbs in general. So I want to do this right and get the best usage I can out of each herb I collect.
All right. So glad that you are new to herbs and that you are reaching out for help. One of the rules that I encourage my students to use is do not ever pick any plant until you know what you are going to do with it. So, you've already broken the first rule, haven't you? You've gone out and you've picked plants and you have no idea what you're going to do with these plants. So, personally, what I would say is compost them. I will tell you that many of my native teachers say that you can't possibly make medicine when you've just picked a plant and not told the plant beforehand what you want it to do. So since you don't have anything in mind, and since you didn't ask the plant for specific help, I believe that the best use of this plant material that you've gathered is your compost pile. And I urge you in the future to only harvest things that you know about, to only harvest things after you have talked to the plant and told it what your intended use is, and to only harvest things when you are prepared to make use of them immediately. For instance, when I'm harvesting stinging nettle to dry, I only harvest for 10 or 15 minutes, then I go and hang it up because I do not want to harvest more than I can hang to dry. For instance, if I'm going to harvest a plant and want to dry it, I would sit with the plant and I would say to the plant, I want to harvest some of your leaves and make an infusion or a tea of your leaves, and I would like you to guide me in how I might do this. What is the best time of the day for me to harvest your leaves? What is the best time of the year for me to harvest your leaves? Should I harvest young leaves or old leaves? Is it best if I use your leaves fresh or is it best if I use your leaves dried? Taking, for instance, my Green Allies correspondence course or coming here to the Wise Woman Center, either as an apprentice or as a workshop student for the Talking with Plants segment, will give you more information on talking with plants, but anyone can hear from plants simply by taking the time to sit with that plant. I suggest 10 minutes a day for a minimum of 10 days of sitting and breathing with the plant that you wish to be in communion with. And once you have done that, then to begin asking that plant the questions that you have about how it should be used, how it should be prepared, how it should be harvested. I remember David Winston's stories about learning about plants with his Cherokee teacher. And David would be out in the forest, and he would come back, and he would say to his teacher, I found this amazing plant, and it looks like this and this. And I want to know how to use it. And his teacher would say, oh, I am so sorry. I cannot tell you how to use that plant until you can sing the song of the plant for me. And so David would have to go back, and he would have to sit with the plant. Sometimes, he said, for long times, until he could hear the song of the plant. And then when he could hear the song of the plant, he would go back to his teacher, and he would sing the song of the plant for his teacher. At that point, his teacher would say, now I can teach you about the plant. And David said most of the time he would look at his teacher and he would say, don't bother, the plant has already taught me. And his teacher would laugh and say, that's exactly how it should be. So I invite you into the wonderful world of green blessings. I invite you to really, as a beginner, go to the plant. Not the expert, not the book. Go to the plant. And please stop harvesting until you know what you're doing. I would never powder an herb. I would never make an oil from a dried herb. I don't live where salal grows, although when I'm around it, I eat the berries and turn my mouth and tongue purple. And I don't use alder leaves either. So I have no personal experience of using these things. And there are many, many, many plants around you that have wide-ranging uses. So rather than focusing on the strange and esoteric, I urge you to instead learn about, as a beginning herbalist, the weeds that grow around you, the dandelion and the lamb's quarters, the chickweed and the yellow dock, the burdock and the purslane, and the amaranth. Make use of the weeds that grow around you, and maybe in 10 or 15 years, you'll spiral back around to the salal, and at that point, you and salal will have a relationship, and you'll be calling me and telling me how you're using it. I await that day with great anticipation and glee. Green blessings.
Okay, another email question. Good morning, Susan. I know you are a very busy entrepreneur, but I have issues that I believe you can help me with. I am a 41-year-old woman with no children. For the past 2 years, I know I shouldn't have waited this long. I have been experiencing a lot of women problems. Irregular cycles, consistent yeast infections, anal sores, low libido, and more. My husband has been suffering so much, he's wondering if he still wants me. I can't have sex because it feels like needles are sticking me during intercourse. It's been 2 months now, but before the sex pain was bearable, not anymore. It has affected everything in my life. During the time of the month, it gets worse. Usually the week before my flow, a lot more itching and burning. And then also when the flow arrives the following week. The anal sores itching just started 2 months ago. Cannot take this constant pain every day anymore. Can you recommend a salve to relieve itching and burning and a tea or herb to cleanse the white discharge? So painful. I have been trying to change eating habits too. Thank you for your time. I am ready for a change. I love my husband dearly and hate that he suffers while I'm suffering.
Again, I believe that we have a woman in menopause here. And certainly there's some other things going on. But the low libido, the sudden pain, the yeast infections, these actually are symptoms of menopause. Now, you know, the scientific tradition, there are no menopausal women. There are premenopausal women, And there are postmenopausal women, but they're not women who are menopausal, because menopause, to the scientific reason, is just the day that you shed the last drop of blood, and you don't even know what day that is because you don't know if there's going to be another, right? So that's not how women experience menopause. Women experience menopause as a period of about 10 years from when they first start to get kind of nebulous symptoms. In my book, I say, if you're asking, is it menopause, it is, until the point where they can actually look back and say, you know what, it's been more than a year since I've had a period, and I'm now on the other side heading toward post-menopause. Even then, the period can come back. I actually met a woman who got pregnant 3 years after her last period. A lot of things going on. So I certainly would recommend my book, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way. And even more so, I would recommend my book, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health of the Wise Woman Way. And I have an entire chapter on various vaginal discharges and the meaning of various vaginal discharges. Now, one of the things that has become fairly clear is that women who feel that they have a yeast infection that they can't get rid of usually have something in addition to a yeast infection. In other words, you may be seeing and smelling the kind of typical white yeasty stuff that goes along with a yeast infection. But if you are unsuccessful at getting rid of it, and usually very simple remedies get rid of that, because after all, that yeast lives in our vaginas all of the time. When the vaginal pH, the acid alkaline value in the vagina changes, then the yeast, which is already there, starts to grow. So when you say that you're improving your diet, I always give it a little, oh my goodness. Goodness only knows what people are doing when they're saying that they're improving their diet. And unfortunately, about 90% of the time when people say they're improving their diet, they are not improving their diet at all. So for you, you would want to look again in, down there, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. And on page 126, you will find a box that says alkalinizers and a box that says acidity restorers. Alkalinizers make the vagina susceptible to infection and pain. Male ejaculate, birth control pills, hormone therapy, diabetes, high blood sugar, antibiotics, stress, even positive stress, bubble bath, washing your vagina, letting feces somehow get into the vagina, and that can be happening because you are complaining of anal cracks, douching, using feminine hygiene sprays, eating anything with artificial sweeteners, drinking diet sodas, eating raw fruit, drinking fruit juice. All right, hormonal changes that precede menstruation, which you mentioned in your note, menstrual fluids themselves, which you also mentioned in your note. What restores acidity and makes the vagina resistant to infections? Yogurt, both orally and vaginally. Acidophilus capsules inserted up into the vagina. Ascorbic acid capsules inserted up into the vagina. And a variety of different sitz baths. All right, a handful of salt in a quart of warm water, or a couple of tablespoons of vinegar in a quart of warm water will help to acidify the vagina. I remember hearing a woman in Germany who told me that, and she was a woman in her 30s, quite a bit younger than you, that she just seemed to have one vaginal infection after another, and then she started to get anal cracks, and she said she just felt like everything down there was in horrible, horrible pain, and she tried one thing after another, and none really seemed to do anything more than just give her a little bit of comfort for a short amount of time, until she happened upon reading about oak bark. And oak bark is exactly what it sounds like. It is literally the bark of the oak tree. Many times when herbalists talk about bark, we're kind of being devious. We really mean the inner bark. But with oak, we actually mean the bark. You can just go to somebody's woodpile and pick it up. Toss a couple of big pieces of oak bark into a pan and bring it up to a boil. Then turn the fire off and shove it to the back of the stove with a good lid on it and let it sit there for, 4, 5, 6 hours, even longer. When you're done, you can use the liquid at room temperature or you can heat it up again and pour it into a shallow basin and sit your bottom down in it. Oak bark has a variety of effects on those tissues. First of all, it is an astringent. It is going to close up and dry up the fissures, the fistulas, the sores that are going on in the anal area. It is going to dry up that profuse yeasty discharge. It is going to re-acidify the vagina, and oak bark is directly antibacterial. So if, in addition to the yeast infection, there are, as is probably the case, other bacterial infections, then you will find the oak bark sitz bath your wonderful ally for removing and dealing with all of this. I usually recommend that you throw that sitz bath water out and make a whole new one for the next time. Once any infection is gone, once any sores are gone, if you still want to do an oak bark sitz bath, then you can reuse the sitz bath liquid, the oak liquid. But please don't reuse it if there is any kind of active infection or if there's any kind of open sore, since it's so easy to make. It's not a problem to make it over and over again. I am always amazed when people seem to believe that sexual intimacy starts with intercourse, ends with intercourse, and is intercourse. And I often ask people, did Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky have sex? Now, most people, I would say 99.9% of people that I ask this question do say, of course they had sex. And I say, well, guess what? They didn't have intercourse. At least, you know, if we were to believe them, and I think that, you know, once the facts were out, there was no reason for them to deny it. They did a whole lot of other stuff, though, didn't they? Oh, the blue dress and under the desk, and oh, my goodness gracious sakes alive. Well, dang, we've got to be more creative here. There is a sexual practice called frottage. Frottage is quite enjoyed by lesbians, and frottage basically means rubbing your sexual organs on some part of the other person's body. So, to be really specific for you, if it is uncomfortable for you to have your husband's penis in your vagina, lubricate your breasts and smush them together and let him put his penis in between your breasts. It feels very much the same to him, and you might even like it as well. Or lubricate your sexual area, but don't attempt to actually put his penis in your vagina. Let the penis slide through your thighs instead. You can actually bring it up to meet your clitoris. And once again, he will enjoy this, and you might find yourself enjoying it too. Sexual intimacy does not require a penis and a vagina, nor does it require the insertion of one thing into another thing. If your husband is suffering, then I think he has a mental health issue. There's certainly no reason for him to suffer, all right? You're holding him, looking into his eyes, whispering things, yelling things to him while he masturbates is a perfectly acceptable form of intimacy. No suffering required. Please get my book down there, Sexual and Reproductive Health, where you can read in great detail a lot of things that you can do to improve your health and enjoy your intimacy more.
All right.
Oh,
thank
my
you.
Goodness. There goes our first hour, huh?
Yes. let's continue on with some email questions. What would you recommend doing, not doing, or adding to my life to nourish my skin and not balance but support my hormones, if indeed they are the cause of the spots? Should I drink burdock nourishing herbal infusions as well as taking burdock tincture, and what dose of the tincture? That is the whole question.
Golly gee. This person is speaking to me as though I know her, as though I know what's going on with her, as though we have spoken previously, and perhaps that's true, but I'm not getting enough clues for that to come up in my memory. So I really don't know what to say. You're certainly not giving me anywhere near enough information to know what is going on. We don't even know where the spots are. We don't even know what the spots look like. Are they ink spots? Are they pimples? What kind of spots are we talking about? I do apologize. I know that because I am autistic, that I do not have the ability to infer from what people say, and I see that a lot of other people can do that, that you kind of throw them out, you know, a few nouns and a verb or two, and they can make up an entire story about what you mean. And I also see that most of the time people are absolutely wrong about the stories that they make up, but I do see them doing that. I'm just not capable of doing that. I simply go on exactly what I'm told, and you're not telling me enough for me to answer. Certainly, burdock is known to be helpful in terms of the skin. Whether or not this is hormonal, again, I do not have enough information. If you were to say, oh, I get massive pimple breakouts on my nose every month in the week before my period, well, then we could probably say, well, this is probably a response to some hormones that are going on in your blood. And to make this simple for us all, it's not the hormones themselves that are problematic. It's the liver's inability to get rid of those hormones that's the problem. So what's happening is that every minute of every hour of every day that we are alive, our bodies produce hormones. They don't produce hormones like a rain shower. They produce hormones in pulses. So there's a pulse of a hormone. There's a pulse of a hormone. And all hormones are related to each other. And when they are in the bloodstream, the liver is supposed to take those hormones apart into their constituent pieces so that the body can use those pieces to make more hormones, right, since we don't necessarily have to consume what we need to make those. If a lot of hormones are being made, or if the liver is not really up to taking them apart, then what happens? It's kind of a twofold mess up. One, hormones continue to circulate in the blood, and hormones are messengers, right? So hormones carry messages past their time of usefulness. And this is very confusing, right? It's kind of like if there was somebody knocking at your door and going trick-or-treat, and you're going, excuse me, that was like last week. You know, and we're going, oh, well, I didn't know. I still thought we could trick or treat. So it's like, no, you know. So the liver is supposed to be taking the hormones apart. If it doesn't, then they keep going around with their messages, and their messages are way out of date. Not only that, when the liver is not taking the hormones apart, new hormones don't get made in the appropriate amounts. And I don't want to make this too complicated for you, but a great many hormones can be made by the body, but they're made in what's called an inactive state. And there has to be one or more enzymes that are also made by the body at the same time, which actually activate the hormones so that they can be used in health and metabolism in the body. And when the liver is not working well and there's too many hormones piling up in the blood because the liver hasn't taken them apart, then those enzymes are no longer produced. So, burdock has some mild effect on the liver. Again, it's a great herb. I love burdock. Dandelion, however, has a stronger effect on the liver. And dandelion is also known as an herb to help with the skin. So, have you been using burdock tincture? Has it been effective for you? Have you been drinking burdock infusion? Has it been effective for you? If the answer to either one of these is yes, I've been doing it, and yes, it's been effective, well, then I would say carry on, keep on doing it. You certainly don't need to double up with the infusion and the tincture. But if your answer is no, I haven't been doing it, or no, it hasn't been effective, then you might want to consider dandelion as an ally. Kind of a general question, kind of a general answer. Hope it helps. Green blessings.
All right, next question. I recently attended the Southeastern Wise Woman Herbal Conference in the Black Mountain. This was the second year I attended. I took your class on mints. I had a few questions I was hoping you could answer. I would like to start taking something for anxiety, depression. I bought a tincture of lemon balm and St. John's wort. Unfortunately, I cannot take this due to my taking birth control pills. And I have some dried lemon balm leaves, but am not sure what to do with them. I would love your advice on what I could make as far as teas or tinctures to help with anxiety and depression. I am willing to grow my own herbs to use for this. I would also need dosages. Thank you for your time and look forward to the conference next year.
Well, of course, one of the first things that Susan is going to say is, once again, this is why I never like to see remedies mixed. Here's a woman who quite rightly does not want to take St. John's wort, Hypericum perforatum, because she's taking birth control pills, and they do make it more likely to get pregnant if you're taking birth control pills, because Hypericum increases the liver's ability to get rid of hormones, to take those hormones apart, just what we were talking about. Right? It is a liver-active herb. Of course, there are actually other liver-active herbs as well that do that, but Hypericum has really gotten a bad rap on it, so I certainly support her desire to not take that. And unfortunately, the lemon balm, which is a great choice for her, was mixed together, it sounds like, in a tincture with it. I am a simpler because I really, really love to use herbs one at a time. Now, I will admit that I personally don't like lemon balm at all. It's just not an herb that appeals to me, but it does appeal to a great many people. And the people that I have heard talking about lemon balm, well, when they drink lemon balm tea, they're not getting much of anything from it, and we would never want to make an infusion from an herb that is aromatic because that would be hard on the kidneys and the liver. So usually people do tincture the fresh lemon balm. You could very easily grow lemon balm, and if you want to grow lemon balm and tincture your own, there's certainly no reason at all not to do that. Unless you're living someplace very high in the mountains where there's already snow on the ground, you could probably even get a lemon balm plant in the ground this year. So it'd be ready to go, raring to go next year for you to make your lemon balm tincture. Meanwhile, you might want to buy some lemon balm tincture. Just make sure that they made it from the fresh plant material. And what I hear is it's useless made from dried plant material, and that's certainly been my experience too, that tinctures made from fresh plant material are so much better than any tincture made from any dried plant material. And if it's an aromatic herb, some aromatic herbs, I even take the vodka and the jar right to the plant. I don't even want to harvest it and bring it in the house, already losing its aroma, already losing its energy there. So fresh tincture of fresh lemon balm could be a wonderful ally for you. Motherwort is another mint, and we did talk about it in the mint class. And motherwort is my favorite for helping anyone who is anxious. Motherwort is a direct reliever of anxiety, and it can be taken, right at the time. So if you're feeling anxious, you can have your motherwort tincture with you, and you can take 5 to 10 drops of motherwort in a small amount of liquid. I have the hiccups. I'm trying to avoid hicking into the telephone. All right, take that motherwort tincture, and it will calm you down immediately. I often ask women, what is it that's making you feel anxious? And my teachers taught me that what it is I fear is also what I hope for. And that if I can turn my anxiety into a fear and then look within the crystal heart of that fear to see what is there, I will find a priceless treasure, something that I really want. Perhaps this could be useful for you. Depression is a term that is flung about a lot. Our Tai Chi teacher talks to us about amoebas. It's a very simple form, and that's what we're trying to achieve in Tai Chi, is simplicity. And he talks about an experiment in which they took an amoeba and poked it from all directions with sharp needles. And the amoeba, not having the capacity to get angry, simply curled up and died. Are you being poked from all sides with sharp needles? You're not an amoeba. Stop curling up and dying. Stand up and scream. Stamp your feet. Say, no, 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 no. I will not take this anymore. My experience, and I'm not a therapist, but my experience, which spans nearly 50 years now, is that the vast majority of women who tell me they're depressed are not depressed. They're angry. They're very, very angry. Things are going down in their lives. They don't like it all, and they don't feel like they have the power to stand up and say no. So instead they say, I'm depressed. I don't know you. I don't have much information about you. But maybe this is something that can be helpful to you. Drink your nourishing herbal infusions. You knew I was going to say that, didn't you? Green blessings.
All right, next question. I am interested in making Susan Weed's nettle vinegar, and I have a question about it. Would it be possible to make it with half vinegar and half water, or on a 3-2 ratio of vinegar to water so that I can consume more quantity? Any guidance would be sincerely appreciated.
Susan Weed doesn't make nettle vinegar. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm sitting here looking at my vinegar shelves, and I must have 50 different plants up in vinegar here. I have lemon balm vinegar, thyme vinegar, garlic stalk vinegar, dill over the ground vinegar, sage vinegar. I have basil vinegar. I have thyme vinegar. I go on and on and on, but there's not a single nettle vinegar here. So I don't know what you mean about Susan Weed nettle vinegar. If you are going to make vinegar, then you make vinegar. You don't go around putting water in your vinegar. No. No, 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 absolutely not. If you want to make vinegar, you use pure apple cider vinegar, fresh plants. You fill your jar right up to the top with your fresh plants. You pour your pasteurized apple cider vinegar over it. You put a non-metal lid on it, and you wait patiently for 6 weeks, and then you can use it. Hey, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with nettle vinegar. It's just boring and dull. Oh, my goodness. I can't imagine why anybody would want to make a vinegar of nettle when there's so many other wonderful and interesting things. You want more nettle? Try your nettle. Make nettle infusion way out with a scale, 1 ounce of dried nettle. Put it in a quart jar. Fill that jar to the top with boiling water. Tightly lid it and let it sit 4 hours or overnight. Strain it, squeezing the herb to get all the liquid out of the herb. Refrigerate your nettle infusion and drink your nettle infusion. That's how we get lots of nettle. Vinegars are for putting on our beans or our salads or splashing under our armpits so we don't stink. They're not designed to get the maximum amount of nourishment from the plant. So make your nettle infusion, and any vinegar you want, use only all vinegar, no water. It's going to rot. You add water to it, it's going to rot. It's going to be a nasty mess. Green blessings.
Next question. I am so grateful to have found your website. I believed in the power of plant medicine and have been searching for a way to educate myself with the help of a trained herbalist. I recently had to take a year off work due to hypertension, which was induced from my stressful work situation. I am currently on meds for hypertension and am trying to conceive but have a short LH phase along with a delayed ovulation time. I believe in herbs and energy work. I am reaching out for guidance on two things. One, how can I heal myself with herbs and become an herbalist myself? And secondly, are there any individuals in Washington State, specifically near Everett, that have trained under you?
So let me answer the last part first, and to say that there's a forum at my website, and this is a great place to take that kind of question. Is there anybody living in Washington who's trained with Susan who's currently teaching? And see what kind of answers you get there. Just go to susanweed.com and find the forum and post your question at the forum and see what happens. Having graduated more than 300 apprentices, as well as my Florida apprentice group, my German apprentice group, the Live Out apprentices, over years and years and years, it's just too much for me to personally keep track of each and every one of them and what they're doing right now. So I hope the forum really works for you. And then you wanted to know about healing yourself and about becoming an herbalist yourself. And I tell all of my students that it takes 7 lifetimes to become an herbalist, and thus you must be patient with yourself. You must be gentle and compassionate with yourself as you work with herbs. I find that by choosing a green ally, which is one plant that you are going to focus in on, and by breathing with that green ally for 10 minutes a day, that you can really move yourself into feeling strong and competent with herbal medicine. I do offer a Green Allies correspondence course to help you if you want further projects in getting in touch with that one plant. As someone who wants to be healthier, of course, my primary suggestion is drink nourishing herbal infusions a quart a day and eat a wide diet that contains foods from all sources, the land and the ocean, animals and plants. Eat those foods non-processed, in other words, in their whole state, but cooked. The vast majority, if not all, of the food needs to be, have the cell walls broken, especially vegetable and fruit foods. And that can be through heat, through cold, fermentation, dehydration, or covering in oil. Now, was there, at the beginning of the letter, Rebecca, was there a specific health concern that she had?
She stated that she had to take a year off of work due to hypertension, which was induced from a stressful work situation, and that she's been trying to conceive, but she has a short LH luteinizing hormone phase along with
delayed ovulation time. I wasn't quite clear what the question was. I remember
yeah,
all of that.
She doesn't really ask a question about that. But
she doesn't really ask any question there. So it leaves me kind of like, again, am I supposed to make up what she wants? Is she asking about herbs? Well, gee, I wouldn't go take any drugs if I was interested in herbs. The first thing I would do if I had hypertension is I would initiate a meditation practice. And 5 minutes a day for many people is really enough to drop your blood pressure. I'm also not completely convinced that stress at work could cause a rise in blood pressure. Possible, but not completely convinced at that. And if the meditation was not enough, you certainly go back and listen to some of the archived talks that I've had with other people. And especially, what was it? Was it like a couple of weeks ago, Rebecca, that someone called in and said, wow, you know, the herbs that you suggested for reducing my high blood pressure worked and worked faster than drugs? Was that last week or the week before? Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. So, again, I'm like just like scratching my head here. Oh, I really want to be an herbalist and I want to learn about herbs, and I'm taking drugs for something as simple as high blood pressure? What? You know, again, if you look in my books, you'll see the 6 steps of healing. And those 6 steps are ordered according to the order that we want to approach our problem. So step one is do nothing. That would be a meditation practice, right? The next step is collect information. You know, what's the problem with high blood pressure? Certainly, it can increase the risk of stroke, but high blood pressure isn't going to immediately cause a stroke, so we really do have some time to work with it. Mind medicine. Well, I have been taught by my teachers that it is not stress that is harmful at all. It is my reaction to the stress, and that I am in control of my reaction to the stress, although I am never going to be in control of the stress. So my teachers have certainly caused me to believe that I should not think of myself as a victim, that if something that's happening is very stressful, that I'm not being victimized by it, I can still choose how to relate to that stress and not be the victim of the stress. Motherwort tincture lowers blood pressure. Hawthorn tincture lowers blood pressure. Passion flower tincture lowers blood pressure. All three of these herbs work effectively, quickly, usually more quickly than drugs, and do not have the side effects of drugs. I hope that you will listen to all of the things that I have said this evening already about getting pregnant and see if any of those apply to you. If they do, please feel free to use them. And if they don't, please write or call with just a more specific question about how I can help you in terms of getting pregnant, what you've done, what you haven't done, and so on. Green blessings.
All right.
Well, it looks like we might have time for what, one more?
Yes, let's try to get one more in. I was wondering what sort of herbs you suggest that would be good for hair loss in menopausal women. Thank you.
Well, this one I know how to interpret because it's such a common one. But let's think about, what did this woman just ask? She asked for an herb that's good for hair loss. In other words, she wants me to tell her how she can lose her hair. Well, now, obviously she doesn't. That's just kind of a messed up way of speaking that people have. And in my green book, Healing Wise, we actually had a Those With editor. And the Those With editor made sure that I did not fall into that pattern, that I didn't say dandelion is for dandruff. I said dandelion is for those with dandruff. Stinging nettle is the herb that is most useful in maintaining healthy hair follicles and healthy hair. both drinking stinging nettle as an infusion and using the infusion as a hindrance are two excellent ways to help our hair be thicker, fuller, and just a lot more fun. When I wrote Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, I really felt I had a fire to my heels. I had to get this book written before I got into menopause and lost my mind and didn't know what to do. I was writing the book really for myself, but there were some things that I had to leave out because of that fire at my heels, and so I revised it, and it became New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and I got to include a lot of topics I didn't get to include in the first edition. I got to include fibromyalgia, restless leg syndrome, thyroid health, herbs for women who are taking hormones, fertility after 40, memory problems, interstitial cystitis, and hairy problems. Because it's not just that we lose hair during menopause, we can also start growing hair in strange places, or maybe not so strange places, like our chin. All right. I love the quote of the woman who helped me paste up this book. She says, hair everywhere. I have 7 cats, and believe me when I say there's a lot of hair in my life, but I was totally unprepared to find so much of mine lying about. I became obsessed with my hair loss. I imagined life with wigs. Surely I would be bald in months if it kept up at this rate, but that didn't happen. I wish I'd simply known that it's common to lose hair during menopause, and it all grows back. So, again, there's an entire chapter here on hair loss in New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and then another chapter on too much hair as well. So get yourself some stinging nettle, dried stinging nettle, and a little scale, weigh out 1 ounce of stinging nettle, pop it into a quart jar, pour boiling water right up to the top, put a tight lid on it, and let it steep just like that, 4 hours or overnight, strain it the next day. Drink most of it, but save a little bit to pour over your head and rub into your scalp. I'm going to guess that within 8 to 12 days, you are going to see a tremendous change in your hair, although you might still continue to lose some hair for a while. It has to do with menopause. Not to worry. Well, that should take us just about up to the time to be talking to Susan Shumsky.
She is here.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and get started then?
All right. Have a good night. Susan, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
We certainly can. Thank you, Rebecca. You have a lovely night, too.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Dr. Susan Shumsky has dedicated her life to helping other people take command of their lives in effective, powerful, and positive ways. She's the author of 10 books and a pioneer in the human potential field, and has spent more than 45 years teaching thousands of people meditation, prayer, affirmation, and intuition. Her books include Miracle Prayer, Divine Revelation, Exploring Meditation, Exploring Auras, Exploring Chakras, How to Hear the Voice of God, Ascension, Instant Healing, The Power of Auras, and The Power of Chakras. Dr. Shumsky is a highly respected spiritual teacher, an award-winning author, and the founder of Divine Revelation, a unique field-proven technology for contacting the divine presence, hearing and testing the inner voice, and receiving clear divine guidance. For 22 years, her mentor was Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, guru of the Beatles and of Deepak Chopra. She has served on Maharishi's personal staff for 7 years. A sought-after media guest and highly acclaimed professional speaker, Dr. Shumsky has done over 600 speaking engagements and over 600 media appearances since her first book was published. And she's featured in the movie Three Magic Wands. I am so excited that you are here with us this evening, Dr. Shumsky.
I'm thrilled to be here also.
What's your latest book?
The book that just came out is called The Power of Auras. And then in 2 weeks, the next book that comes out will be The Power of Chakras.
Okay, so you have two books coming out pretty close together. And,
yes,
of course, auras and chakras are interwoven and interlinked.
That's right.
So perhaps some of our listeners are unfamiliar with these terms. Maybe we should start by having you explain what an aura is and what a chakra is.
Okay, great. So an aura comes from a Greek word, avra, which means breath of air. And the reason why that word comes from this breath of air is because we have this gross physical body that we inhabit, but we also have a subtle body. And the subtle body is invisible to our normal human sight, but it is visible to clairvoyance, clairaudience, clairsentience. And that subtle body is what gives us life. An aspect of that subtle body is our energy body, otherwise known as the pranic body. Prana meaning the life force energy that gives us life. And prana is an Indian term for that life force energy. In China, they call it qi, and in Japan, they call it ki. And that particular energy is what's keeping us alive. This physical body has no life in it. Our subtle body is what gives us life. So that's why it's called an aura.
So the aura comes from a Greek word that means breath.
Yes, breath of life, yeah.
Oh, it literally means breath of life, not just
exactly.
Breath.
Breath of life.
Breath of life. And you're relating that breath of life to both prana and chi.
Well, prana and chi are exactly the same thing. Prana is the Sanskrit word for it. Chi is a Chinese word for it. And ki is the Japanese word for it. So that breath of life, that life force energy, which gives us life, is contained within our subtle body, otherwise known as the aura. Now, you also wanted me to define the word chakra. Chakra is a Sanskrit word, and it means wheel. Literally, it means wheel. And the reason it is a wheel is because it is a hub of pranic energy. In our subtle body, in the aspect of our subtle body called the pranamaya kosha, or the pranic body, the energy body, there are conduits of subtle energy running through that body. And those are called nadi. And when you have many nadi coming together in a plexus of energy, then you have a chakra. Chakra meaning it has spokes and it has a hub. And the spokes are the nadi, and the hub is the central chakra, that hub of energy which gives life to the body and which regulates the body. There are seven main chakras throughout the body, seven of them, and they mainly are connected to the endocrine system. But there are many other chakras. In fact, there's hundreds of chakras in your body. Every meridian point in acupressure is a chakra.
Yes, that's also what I have been told as well, is that every tsubo in the acupuncture system is a chakra. And we will often see in esoteric paintings chakras in the hands, chakras in the feet.
Yes, there are these points of energy, these hubs of energy are all over our subtle body, yes.
Yeah.
Although if you actually dissected a corpse, you're not going to find a chakra or a nadi or prana anywhere because it's in your subtle body. It's not in this gross physical body.
I think what you're saying, please correct me if I'm wrong, is it's not in the gross physical body when we're dead, but it is in the body when we're alive because it's what animates the body.
It does animate the body, but it is separate from the body. In fact, there's five different sheaths to our fivefold sheath. Our fivefold sheath is the five koshas, K-O-S-H-A, and that is a Sanskrit term for five layers of our body. Okay, so the gross layer is the physical body, which is called the anamaya kosha. And anamaya means food. It's the food sheath. Kosha means sheath, and anamaya is the food sheath. The reason why it is food sheath is because it's made of food, sustained by food, and it becomes food for something else after we're gone. So that would be the food sheath. Then we have the pranic sheath or the energy sheath that we've just been talking about, which is called the pranamaya kosha. And that is where this life force energy is running through that subtle body and regulating the gross physical body. It is said in the ancient Upanishads of India that when prana is in the body, that is defined as life. When prana leaves the body, that is what is defined as death. So at death, that pranic body and all of the other layers of your subtle body withdraw from your physical body. The next layer of your koshas is called the mental body or the manamaya kosha. And that aspect of the mental body is the aspect through which you experience conscious awareness, through which you experience through the senses, hearing, taste, smell, touch, feeling, and so forth. So that would be the manamaya kosha, the mental body. And then there's another body, which is called the vijnanamaya kosha, which is your intellect and ego body. That houses your sense of separation, of being the I that's separate from everybody else. That's the ego. And also your intellect, which is your ability to decide and discern and to be able to have higher intellectual experience in the mind. And then the subtlest body is called the Anandamaya Kosha, which literally translated as your blissful sheath. That's your causal body, and that is what causes you to individuate, to be separate from other things in the universe. So that's your fivefold sheath. So when you're talking about an aura, you're talking about all those sheaths together.
Now, I tend to think of auras as having color.
Right. So those with clairvoyant sight can see the mental body, the manamaya kosha that we're talking about.
Yeah.
You can see colors in that aspect of your aura. And depending on what color shows, and also depending on if there are certain anomalies in the aura, or if there are streaks or spots, or there's so many different things that can be contained within that energy field, within that aura, those who have clairvoyant sight can see, or those who have clairsentience, they can feel. In fact, everybody feels auras. Anybody who walks into a room and immediately you sense a kind of vibration, oh, this has really good vibes in here, this feels warm, this feels friendly, or you go into another place, oh, this has a really bad vibe, a place like this, you know, I just feel like I'm being drained, my energy is being drained from this kind of place. You're sensing the energy, the subtle energies within that place. Or you might meet an individual and immediately you think, oh, this person seems really friendly. This person seems open. This person seems loving. another person you meet, oh, this person seems very closed off. This person, another person maybe, this person, I feel anger, I feel frustration in this person. This person seems really uptight. So that's what we're doing when we're sensing these vibrations of a person or a place. We're sensing that subtle energy field. We're sensing the aura of that person or place.
So what some people might call like a gut sense or an intuition is actually that we're picking up information within our subtle bodies from other subtle bodies.
Well, yes, that's one way to receive a kind of a gut feeling about a person or a place, definitely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you were talking about anomalies.
Yes, it's very interesting. When I first started to, when my publisher asked me to write the book, the Auras book, immediately, for some bizarre reason, so many people started coming to me with strange anomalies in their energy fields, and I figured it must be because Spirit wanted me to write this book, and they wanted me to put all these different odd things that I'm seeing into the book. There was one case in which a woman came to me, and she said that she needed healing, and when I looked into her energy field, I saw this strange anomaly. It looked like a big steel plate in front of her body. The woman had expressed that she had been learning from or studying with a teacher. Let's call that teacher Krishna, just for the heck of it. So she said she was going to see this Krishna guy, and so I put two and two together, and Spirit showed me that this plate had been deposited, it had been installed into her energy field by this teacher, consciously. And that's possible to do. You know, people could do that. This plate was something that was not a good thing. It was blocking her, actually. So I healed and released it. And amazingly, at the end of our session, the woman asked me, well, should I still continue to study with Krishna? And I said, well, if you want to have a psychic plate in front of your body where you can't see clairvoyantly, you can't hear the music of the spheres, you can't receive divine revelation or intuition, and you are blocked from spiritual experience, sure, by all means, continue to study with Krishna. So this just shows us that people are gullible, people are don't really understand much about energy, and unfortunately people get duped easily by others who might have nefarious motives in mind when they install things into our energy field. So I've seen, as a result of so many people coming to me, I've seen all kinds of strange anomalies in people's fields. I mean, one thing is obviously psychic ties, which I had a lot of experience with myself long before I ever wrote the book. But there are also things like psychic, you know, they're more like tentacles or like an octopus kind of thing, very strong psychic ties. There can also be psychic shackles, psychic jails, psychic boots, psychic clamps. There are people who find themselves with psychic nets, and they're just, you know, they're tangled in a net. I've seen hooks on people, on their backs or other places, psychic hooks, psychic arrows. I've seen inflamed auras that are just, they're like on fire. I mean, there's all kinds of very strange things that you find in people's auras. And if a person is ill, there might be black spots, there might be dark streaks like that. Then there's also, of course, astral entities that can be in people's energy fields that are either oppressing, possessing, or influencing people. There are thought forms. There are psychic vampires. There's all kinds of stuff.
You said that you had a lot of experience with psychic ties. Are those like when we love people?
Now, people really have a very there's a lot of misinformation about psychic ties. Okay, there's two different things, and they're completely separate from each other. One is love ties, and the other is psychic ties. A left tie is a true love bond. It's a golden tie, and it is on the spiritual plane. It's on the spiritual level. So if you have a love tie with someone, a true love bond, that's a completely spiritual relationship. And you might have love ties not only to people, but also to pets, also to your spiritual life, perhaps to a deity. You have love ties, devotional ties, that kind of thing. And, of course, to people, loved ones, you know, mother to child, husband to wife, and so on, these love ties. But there's another kind of tie. It's called a psychic tie. Psychic ties, connections, karmic bonds, binding ties, that's what a psychic tie is. A psychic tie is the leftover from a negative experience. So, for example, maybe you have a fight with your boss, or you have a fight with your husband or your wife. What's left over from that fight? A residue, a resentment, a bad feeling. This is what creates psychic ties. So psychic ties are made out of negative experiences. A psychic tie, by definition, is an undue attachment or repulsion to any person, place, thing, organization, situation, circumstance, memory, experience, or addiction that is influencing you unduly and that is causing problems in your life, basically. So I recommend very highly and very strongly that people cut psychic ties with their loved ones at home, to anyone who lives with them, and anyone that you work with, anyone in your office or wherever you work. Cut psychic ties daily with all those people, especially the ones that are very close to you, and you will, I guarantee, you will have better, more intimate, more loving, more harmonious relationships with those people.
I so completely agree with you, Bea, as I say that resentment is the biggest killer of relationships.
Absolutely.
Resentment has no usefulness to us at all. And I'll tell you an interesting story from my life. I was very much involved with two people. We ran a business together. We owned property together. We were intimately sexually involved. And through a series of misunderstandings over a three-month period, first one and then the other of them left our arrangements and focused in not on their desire for change in their lives, but Susan made us leave. Now, of course, I didn't at all, but that was what they needed to believe. And they began to very viciously attack me. And I mean attack in public, attack in print, you know, not just talking. And being kind of a, you know, new age girl, I thought that the best thing to do would be to meditate on loving kindness and to send these two lots and lots and lots of loving kindness. And you will not be surprised to find that when I opened that psychic tie up to them, they filled it with filth and hate. And I saw, just exactly as you're saying, that I simply had to cut that tie. In fact, I sought out a teacher who taught me about cutting the ties, and her instruction to me was that, very much like what you're saying, was that I had to cut all of my ties with everyone because I was not in a state where I could determine the difference between a love tie and a psychic tie. And I had to simply trust that the love ties would come back and the psychic ties wouldn't. And I was to go chakra by chakra looking for ties. And just to, like you say, they came in all kinds of form. There were buttons. There were hooks. There were zippers. There were amazing, strange things. And it wasn't until I got to my throat chakra that I found these two people. And the tie on my throat was bigger than my throat. And I really, you know, I had undone lots of ties up until then, and I was quaking. I didn't know what to do. I thought, my gosh, if I take this tie off, I'm going to die. And then this image flashed in my mind of being with a midwife, and seeing her tie an umbilical cord in two places and cut between them. And so that's what I did. I took this enormous, big, fat cord that was on my throat. And in fact, it really was, because these two had come into the house and taken over a dozen years of my class notes and took it and published it as a book under their name. And I was able in this way to actually cut this tie, although the end that was coming from them remained in my psychic field trying to reattach itself to me for months. So I want to support very much what Dr. Susan Shumsky is saying here. And that
is... Yeah, that's an amazing experience and very instructive. Because it's important, first of all, to realize that you cannot cut the true love bond. So you don't have to ever worry that you're going to be cutting the true love bonds. Even if you tried to cut them, they can't be cut. And the psychic ties are what you want to cut. So... you might even imagine that you're using a scissors, a sword, or something like that, and you may call upon a divine being to help you to do that. You might use a prayer such as something very similar like this. You might say, I call upon the Holy Spirit to lovingly cut any and all psychic ties between myself and then, of course, you name the person, the place, the thing, whatever it is you're cutting psychic ties with. And then you just say something like this. These psychic ties are all now lovingly cut, 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 cut. And as you're saying that, you're cutting the ties, cut, lifted, loved, healed, released, dissolved, blessed, lifted and let go into the light of God's love and truth. Thank you, God, and so it is. So that would be one method of psychic tie cut. I have a few of them in my book, The Power of Auras, and in my other books as well. So that will help you to maintain more intimate, more loving relationships with people and to let go of the drama, the trauma, the horrible experiences of people who are ripping you off and so on, that, like you experienced, and be able to move on with your life in no longer holding on to those old resentments, those old angers, and all the things that we carry with us in our energy field that all they do is make us sick, really. They're not going to help us.
That's exactly what I was shown, Dr. Shumsky, when I was meditating and I saw the resentment that I had against these people. And I was literally shown how that resentment would play out in my body and how sick it would make me.
Right. Exactly.
And that if I loved myself, that I wouldn't be resentful. As a matter of fact, I mentally cross-stitched a little thing that said, I bless my enemies. They are the ones who make me strong and wise.
Yes.
And turn that resentment into, I have been blessed. I have been blessed with this conflict. I have been blessed with these enemies.
Well, yeah, I mean, what doesn't kill us make us stronger, right?
There you go. But it's not, it wasn't that they were killing me, although they were trying. I was killing myself with my own resentment.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. So you talk about facade bodies, and I've never heard anybody talk about that before. Could you share a little bit about that with us?
Yes. A facade body is made up of a very strong thought form. Okay, a thought form is a...
Do we lose you? Come in, Dr. Susan Shumsky. We seem to have lost her signal. Oh, dear. And Rebecca is no longer at the switchboard able...
I am here, but it says that she's still on, but I don't...
It says that she's still on. We're just not getting any sound.
Maybe she
will
call back in.
Hello, Dr. Shumsky. But it has been such a delight being with Dr. Susan Shumsky. And if you want to know more, if you're interested in all that you're hearing, you can visit her at Dr. Susan, she spells hers with a S-U-S-A-N, Susan. That's www.doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, Susan. She also has, and that's .org, and she also has www.drsusan, D-R-S-U-S-A-N.org. So Dr. Susan, the abbreviation DR, or Dr. Susan, the whole word spelled out, .org. You can also find more information about Dr. Susan Chomsky and her books at www.divinetravels.com. I bet you will be able to find some of her books there, including Miracle Prayer, Divine Revelation, Exploring Meditation, Exploring Auras, Exploring Chakras, How to Hear the Voice of God, Ascension, Instant Healing, and her two new books coming out, The Power of Auras and The Power of Chakras. As usual, you can probably also get Dr. Susan Chomsky's books at that bookseller that's named after a big, strong woman. I know that Dr. Chomsky wanted to tell us that it's quite important right now to do work with our energy fields, to work with the kosha, because this is a very special time for human beings. We are moving into a nexus of very great change. And the work that Dr. Chomsky is doing and the work and the help that she can offer you will help you prepare for this change. So if you're interested in auras, if you're interested in chakras and nadis, if you're interested in kundalini, if you're interested in being divine and hearing the voice of God, please go
she's
and visit.
She's back on here right about now, too.
Dr. Susan E. Okay, well, we could give her the last minute because we got, what, about 2 minutes left of the show. Are you back with us, Susan?
I am. I don't know what happened. You just suddenly disappeared.
Okay. Well, we're so glad that we got you back. And we are at the last minute of our show. Always like
okay.
to offer my guest that last minute. What do you want to leave people feeling? What do you want to leave them thinking about?
Okay, well, what I'd like to do is teach you a very, very simple affirmative prayer that will help you to maintain greater self-authority, self-confidence, self-worth, self-empowerment. And it goes like this. And as you say this, say it as if your higher self is
saying. Dr. Chomsky, we have 40 seconds left.
That's all it takes. Say this as though your higher self is saying it. It goes like this. I am in control. I am one with God. I am the only authority in my life. I am divinely protected by the light of my being. I close off my aura and body of light to the lower astral levels of mind, and I open to the spiritual world. Thank you, God, and so it is.
That is beautiful, and it's now recorded so they can go back and play it over and over again. Thank you, listeners, for being here with Dr. Susan Chomsky and Susan Reed as we reweave the healing cloak of the ancients and make change in our lives and everyone's. Good night and green blessings.